You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcast on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio, and every U.S. military base on Earth. Simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems, over 200 cable systems nationwide. More people watching or listening to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive radio show in the world. And just a quick heads up for those who are watching us on Free Speech TV or listening on Sirius XM, we will be doing a special live three-hour broadcast on Sunday from 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and specifically about 9/11. Just, you know, your thoughts, basically kind of an open line. Well, we may have some interesting guests, but basically it's going to be 9/11. Let's talk about it. I'll share my experiences with it, and you can share yours. All of that said, it's Friday, our first hour of Friday. Of course, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour, I think of him as America's senator. The people in Vermont know that he's theirs, and very proud of it. And Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you back with us. Oh, I should mention your website, sanders.senate.gov, and particularly for people who in Vermont, we've mentioned this before, looking for help with the flooding disasters that have struck, you know, what was once my home state, you know, for 5 years, for almost a decade, actually. The information is at sanders.senate.gov.
Right, Bernie, Tom, let me just start off by mentioning to the people in Vermont who may be listening, we have four or five staff members going around the state checking out towns that have been hard hit. And if my office can provide any information that Vermonters may need, please give us a ring at our toll-free number, 1-800-339-9834. Okay. And we will try to get you as much information as you can, how you can access flood relief.
Okay, and that's a number for Vermonters who are looking for flood relief, not people who want to call into the program.
Right.
To call in, well, I want people know how to call in the program. So, anyhow, last night the president, the night before last, we had the Republican debate. Last night the president gave a speech, some fairly clear contrasts. I'm curious your thoughts on all of the above, particularly the president's speech.
I was there. I thought, A, the speech was very well written, and B, I thought he delivered it very, very well. The issue that we're dealing with, Tom, as everybody knows, is real unemployment in America today is not 9%, it's 16%, counting those people who have given up looking for work and those people who work in part-time who want to work full-time. We have millions more workers who are working longer hours for lower wages than they used to. So we are really in the midst of a horrendous economic crisis not seen since the 1930s. I think the good news is that the president provided maybe a little bit more than some of us had feared. But what remains to be seen is whether, given the extent of the high level of unemployment that we're now facing, whether what he has proposed will go far enough. Certainly and absolutely, he touched on some very, very important issues. As you and I have discussed many times, the infrastructure in this country is collapsing. The American Society of Civil Engineers suggests we need to spend over $2 trillion in the next 5 years just bringing our infrastructure up to a passable level. The president has proposed to put $50 billion into infrastructure. That is a good start. I hope that we can substantially raise that money, not only because we have to rebuild our roads and bridges and water systems and high-speed rail and broadband and so forth, but because that is also the fastest and most effective way of creating jobs. So I think his talking about infrastructure, putting in a significant amount of money, although not enough, is a good start. When the president talks about rehiring some 280,000 teachers, police, and firefighters, he's absolutely right. Local and state governments are stressed out. We have politicians talking about the need to educate our kids so they can compete in the global marketplace. and yet we are laying off hundreds of thousands of teachers, child care workers, etc. That is totally absurd. So the president makes a good point. He is proposing to spend $35 billion in that area. The president wants $10 billion for a national infrastructure bank, which is an interesting concept. He wants $15 billion to rehab homes and vacant properties, which I think is a very, very good idea. So I think when the president talks about investing in America, investing in our kids, investing in our infrastructure, putting veterans back to work, I think he's doing the right thing. Where I have some concerns is a very significant part of this $447 billion package has to do with tax breaks, extending and expanding the payroll tax holiday. Now, what's the problem with the payroll tax holiday? And Tom, not a lot of people are discussing this, but it's important to raise this issue very forcefully. This money is money that is being diverted from the Social Security Trust Fund. So right now people say, well, isn't that great? I'm going to get a $500 or a $1,000 or a $1,500 tax break. Yeah, but that money was supposed to be going into the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, what the president will say is not to worry. The federal government will cover that. We'll cover that. Problem is the federal government has a $14-plus trillion national debt. Social Security is under attack every single day. So I am less than enthusiastic about seeing substantial sums of money diverted from the Social Security Trust Fund. Yes, working families need a tax break, but I want to see that money come from another source other than the Social Security Trust Fund. Second point of concern. President talked about, quote unquote, reforming Medicare and Medicaid. Well, we don't know exactly what that means. If the president is, for example, suggesting that we can save substantial sums of money by having Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry, as does the Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense, that is an excellent reform. Excellent reform. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if his so-called reform means that we're going to raise the eligibility level for Medicare from 65 to 67, that is a disaster for a whole lot of people. I just want people to be thinking about someone who's 66, doesn't have a whole lot of money, and has some serious health issues. Where do you think you're going to be able to get the health care that you need? No insurance company, no private insurance company is going to provide you with a package that will work for you. President also talks about, quote unquote, reforming Medicaid. I don't know exactly what that means. What I do know is we have 50 million people in this country today who have no health insurance. And if reforming Medicaid means throwing people off of Medicaid, that is not a reform that I will support. In terms of health care, whether you talk about Medicare or Medicaid, what must be understood is, of course, we need significant reforms. And the direction that we should be moving is, in my view, is a single-payer Medicare for All program for every man, woman, and child in this country. And I say that not only because it's the moral thing to do, it is the cost-effective thing to do. Right now, as a nation, we are spending close to twice as much per person on health care as do the people of any other nation. So we do need reforms to make our system more cost-effective, but reforms should not mean raising the eligibility age for Medicare or throwing children or working families off of Medicaid.
It's a great analysis. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator Sanders will be back in just a moment with more of your calls, or to take your calls for our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program with Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie, 866-987-THOM, 866-745-2667. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Great news, great information there, great news site, great newsletter, and if you live in Vermont, information on how you can deal with the floods. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us and taking your calls. Stan in Ross, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Before we take this one, let me just continue the response to Steve.
Okay, hold on. Here's the issue. Hold on just a second here, Stan.
Yeah, Steve, if you could just hold on. what seems to me the most effective thing that we could do, whether you call it another WPA or a CCC from the 1930s, the issue is to identify the real needs facing our country, invest in those needs, and you put people to work in that process. For example, everybody knows the horrendous condition of our roads, our bridges, water systems, wastewater plants. Our rail system is falling further and further behind Europe and even China. Airports need a lot of work. Once you identify what has to be done, let's get the work done. And when you do that, call it CCC, call it WPA, call it whatever you want, you're going to put millions of people back to work in this country, making our country more productive, more efficient, more internationally competitive. Of all of the things that we can do that make sense to me to create the millions of jobs that we have to do, that's the direction that we have to go.
Stan in Ross, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. First of all, Tom, thanks for turning me on to Mike Farrell for a documentary. That was really great. I appreciate that. Senator Sanders, I had a question for you. I listened to a speech last night, and I kept waiting and waiting and waiting for the president to mention increase in tariffs in order to get rid of these cheap products coming in from China. This is what's really going to create jobs in the United States. The infrastructure and the rest of them are, I think they're more temporary in the sense that once you complete a project, you hopefully move on to another one. Manufacturing needs to come back to the U.S. in a big way. And I didn't hear a single word about what you described a couple weeks ago about slowly, deliberately raising tariffs on these products to make the level playing field.
Well, let me say this. You did hear a word about it, but the words that you heard were the wrong words. The words that you heard last night is the president indicating once again his support for Bush's trade policy, which includes new trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia. That's what you did hear. And in my view, that's exactly what we should not have been hearing. I agree with the caller that our current trade policy has been an unmitigated disaster, that it is one of the reasons why manufacturing in the United States, manufacturing jobs in the United States have significantly declined, why we have lost 50,000 factories in the last 10 years. Permanent normal trade relations with China has cost us over 2 million jobs. And you don't have to be an economist to know that when you go shopping in a department store, most of the products that you will buy are made in China, that it is harder and harder to buy a product made in the United States of America. And in fact, these trade agreements with Korea, with Colombia, with Panama are only going to continue, in my view, the process of enabling corporations to shut down in America and outsource to these other countries. And I think the caller is absolutely right. We need a new trade policy based on fair trade, not unfettered free trade. American workers should not be forced to compete against people who make a fraction of the wages that we make.
Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont, you're on the air, and thanks for listening to WKPT. What's up?
Tom, it's Steve West calling from WKBT. Senator Sanders, hi. I do radio, so I don't want to spend too much time with you, but I do want to say this. As Senator Sanders knows, and Tom, you've been hearing too, the people of Vermont are amazing and extraordinary. We've seen a lot of it during what's happened in the last couple of weeks. I want to just wrap that into a question that says, I think Vermont can in many ways be a leading example for the rest of the country in terms of what happens when people get together on an individual and community basis and make things happen and don't wait around for governmental intervention. And I wouldn't mind Senator Sanders speaking to that, because the spirit of the people of Vermont has saved lives and is reconstructing our lovely state. And I'm proud to be from Vermont, and I'm proud to be able to represent it on the radio. But I'd love to hear Senator Sanders just talk about the great people of Vermont.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Steve. I was down in Brattleboro last Saturday and then over to Wilmington, a town in south central Vermont, which has really been hit hard. I went to some trailer parks and senior housing in Brattleboro, a town which has also been hit hard. And I think what we are seeing in Vermont, what Steve is talking about, is just a huge number of people coming out to give support to their friends, neighbors. People are coming from other parts of the state. I was down in Wilmington. We had police officers from the northern part of the state coming down and the southern part of the state helping out because they knew the kind of stress that law enforcement people were operating under in Brattleboro and Wilmington. So Steve is absolutely right. But Steve, the issue is, it is people coming together. But the government is going to play a very important role in rebuilding Vermont. That's local government, that's state government, and that is federal government. One of the things we're working on right now is to make sure that we have a significant disaster relief program. We get it passed as quickly as possible, not only to help the communities in Vermont, but to help communities in New Jersey, North Carolina, and other towns that have been hit. But you're absolutely right. Vermonters have really stood up and reached out to help their brothers and sisters.
Dan in Asheville, North Carolina, listening to Maine FM. We have a minute to the break. Dan,
sure.
Your question?
Yes, Senator, the majority of the money in the president's proposed bill comes from tax cuts. Have you changed your mind? Do you believe today that tax cuts create jobs?
No, it's not a question. As I indicated earlier, I believe that we should significantly spend more money in investing in America. That's infrastructure, education, energy. That's the way I think you create jobs. On the other hand, do I think at a time when we're in the midst of a severe recession that working families need some help and that we should provide tax relief to working families? I do. My concern there is that the money now is being diverted from the Social Security Trust Fund, and that concerns me very much.
Right. And there's a difference in the effect of tax breaks for working people and tax breaks for billionaires.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. For anywhere in the country, it's a great news resource. There's links to his Facebook page and his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And for our listeners and viewers in Vermont, if you're dealing with flood-related issues, Senator Sanders' website is a great resource, sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, did you want to give out that 800 number for people in Vermont looking for to contact your office
sure.
for assistance with a flood again?
1-800-339-9834. And that's if our office can be of any help for people who are struggling through the flood and having problems. That's only a Vermont number for people in Vermont.
Okay, and I'm assuming that that's on your website at sanders.senate.gov.
Yes, it is. Sure.
Okay, great. All right, Michael in Monroe, North Carolina, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. We need 67 more senators just like you. I've got a question about Social Security and the, and I know Tom agrees with this, but removing the cap from $106,700 and just removing it completely, will that solve the Social Security problem? If so, how come that isn't brought up over and over again on mainstream media and in the Senate? Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. Well, let me just tell you this. The answer is yes to your question. Lifting the cap will solve the problem for 75 years. It is not talked about terribly often on mainstream media where there is an enormous amount of disinformation. And thirdly, we are going to be introducing next week legislation to do just that, starting at $250,000. You don't have to start it at $106,000. If you started at $250,000, you will in fact solve the problem for 75 years. And here's the issue. Let me say it again. Because Social Security continues to be a target not only for right-wing extremists like Governor Perry, who came up with his brilliant assertion that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, but for other people who simply want to cut benefits for Social Security beneficiaries or ultimately privatize it. Facts again. Social Security, according to a recent report from the CBO, has a $2.5 trillion surplus. Social Security can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 27 years. Social Security, because it's funded by the payroll tax, has not contributed one nickel to the deficit, should not be seen as a problem related to deficit reduction. So the question is, how do you make it strong for 75 years rather than the 27 years? And by the way, at the end of 27 years, it will pay out 80% of the benefits owed to eligible Americans. And the one way, as Michael indicates, to solve that problem is to lift the cap on taxable income above $250,000. You do that, we're going to introduce that bill. As of now, I believe we have four co-sponsors. We're trying to get a few more, and we'll probably introduce it next week.
Ronald in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Ronald, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to ask Senator Sanders a question. How would you go about getting a bill passed through the Republican House since they're so hostile to any type of legislation whatsoever? How would you do it, Senator?
Ronald, thank you for the question, and it's a good question. Clearly, we have a Republican Party today which has moved very, very far to the right. They take their orders from the very wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations, and Tea Party folks are on the extreme right. I think the way to get significant legislation passed, such as a major, major jobs bill, is to take the case to the American people, build a very strong grassroots movement, and give the Republicans, basically make them an offer that they can't refuse. And that is, when thousands of people from your congressional district call in and say, you know what, it is much more important that we have decent paying jobs in our community than giving tax breaks to millionaires or billionaires. And when lots of people get organized, go to town meetings, make those phone calls, you begin to put pressure on Republicans who are politicians. They have got to get reelected. We talked a moment ago about trade agreements. If people in districts call up their senators and their members of House and say, excuse me, we have lost millions of jobs because of these disastrous trade agreements that have enabled corporations to shut down in America, move to China, Vietnam, Mexico, wherever. Stop it. Don't vote for these agreements anymore, or you're not going to get reelected. So to answer Ronald's question, I'm an old-fashioned guy in that respect. I think you build grassroots activism, you have people put pressure on their elected officials, and then the elected officials have a choice. They want to get reelected, they're going to have to start listening to ordinary people rather than to their campaign contributors.
Reginald in Houston, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Hello, Senator. Bernie.
Senator Bernie.
Yes, you're on.
Hey, sir. Reginald Moore. This is Reginald here. Yes, I'm calling. You know, it's been 3 years since the senior citizens have got that on Social Security. People on Social Security have gotten a raise. It's the first time since the creation, since Roosevelt done that. And I'm concerned going into this session here, I haven't heard anything about them getting a raise, a cost of living raise. These are the people who were, you know, in the civil rights movement in the 30s and the 40s. Now they're elderly, widowed, and we have money that we could pay back from on the T-bills that's barred against Social Security that could help fund it. Make sure they get that. Here in Texas, Governor Perry, we were trying to get electronic verification to validate the Social Security verification, and they had the lobbyists and the home builders who lobbied against this in our Senate, and he approved. They went along with it to keep the electronic verification because the jobs are coming here, but the developers and the contractors are using illegal labor because the labor is cheaper when they go that way. Can we validate that and get that electronic verification to make sure that the jobs are going to the citizens and not to pay at the bottom line and exploiting illegal immigrants?
Okay, as I heard you, Reginald, you asked two questions, and the second one is verification of workers to make sure that they are American citizens, and I support that. I think that that's right. The second issue you talked about is Social Security COLAs. What I would tell you, Reginald, you're right. In the last 2 years, people on Social Security haven't gotten any COLA whatsoever, despite the fact that prescription drug costs and healthcare costs in general have gone up very significantly, which impacts mostly senior citizens. What I want to tell you, Reginald, is if you can believe this, there are people here in Washington, and I'm afraid maybe even the president, who think that the current COLA formulation is too generous. Too generous. And they want to move toward what is called a chained CPI, reformulating COLAs, which would lower them. And that would mean in the next 10 years, $560 less for somebody who would be 75, and 20 years from now, $1,000 a year less for somebody who would be 85. So, Reginald, the goal is to create a new formula which effectively determines inflation for seniors. I think the current formula is inadequate. On the other hand, there are those who think it's too generous. Lastly, I suspect, we're not sure about this, there'll be an announcement fairly soon, there probably will be a Social Security COLA this year. My guess is it'll be pretty minimal.
Lily in Binghamton, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, this is Lily. I'd like to ask Senator Sanders, when are we going to get the Republicans to finally start cutting some of the Defense Department budget? We spent $5 trillion. They've increased it to $5 trillion on defense. There's bases, old bases, that we have open up in Europe and in Asia. We could close some of them bases down, and especially in Naples in Italy. We're a military family. We've been to these bases all over Europe. There's all kinds of little bases that could be closed. They're useless. And we can use the other bigger bases that we have. It's time to start cutting some of the defense spending.
Lily, I agree with you. We have tripled defense spending since 1997. Right now we're engaged in a war in Iraq and a war in Afghanistan, costing us about $160 billion a year. And your point is we are defending countries all over the world who are more than able to defend themselves as we end up spending more money on the military than the rest of the world combined. So, Lily, your point is well taken. Unfortunately, we have Republicans right now who say, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut education. Oh, defense spending? No, we want to raise that. So we have our work cut out, but, Lily, I think you're absolutely right.
Dan in Washington, D.C., you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Minute to the break, by the way.
Senator, I'm very troubled by President Obama going in 1 year from a temporary cut in the payroll tax to saying last night that full funding of Social Security would be a tax increase on the middle class. If his proposal to defund Social Security goes forward, would you still be able to say that Social Security is funded in the way it is and that it has not contributed to the national debt, as you said a couple of minutes ago?
Dan, that is an excellent question. I touched on that a few minutes earlier. I opposed the so-called payroll tax holiday last year. I am very concerned about continuing it this year because if you do it 2 years in a row, then it becomes permanent. And if you cut it in half, it means instead of contributing 6.2% of income, people are contributing 3.1%. That means you're diverting tens and tens of billions of dollars into the Social Security Trust Fund. What the president says, as I mentioned earlier, is don't worry. We're going to repay this from the federal treasury. Well, when you got a $14 trillion national debt, I have my doubts. So I think, Dan, the point you are raising is one that has to be made over and over again.
It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. It is our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. Rachel in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. First, thank you for all you do. And my concern regards electronic voting vis-a-vis paper ballots. Do you know of any, measure that will be introduced in either the House or Senate to return to paper voting? I know I lived in Europe for a while, and I'm fairly certain that most European countries have gone back to paper ballots. I know Ireland did. They had a very expensive electronic voting system ready to be implemented, and then they decided just to keep the paper system. And my concern stems from the fact that I really believe that the more people who vote against Republicans, as Republicans see all these people voting against them, they're going to manipulate the system, manipulate computers' voting systems. And I'm just very concerned about that.
Well, I know Tom has done a lot of work on that, so I'm going to give the mic over to Tom. But I will tell you this. One area, Rachel, that we are going to be involved in is the outrageous attacks on voting rights that are taking place in many of these right-wing states, where it is as clear as the noses on our faces that what the officials there are trying to do is make it harder and harder for low-income people, for people of color, for people who don't own automobiles, for people who don't have fancy IDs to be able to vote. And they're doing this under the guise of voter fraud, which thankfully in this country is a virtually non-existent problem, and it has to be dealt with. But to discriminate and to make it harder for lower-income people to vote is an outrage and something we are going to address. In terms of paper ballots, I agree. I mean, I think, interestingly enough, I live an hour away from the Canadian border, and we watch the Canadian elections. They get their election results in quite quickly. There's never any great debates about the accuracy of them, and I think that they do that virtually all with paper. Is that right, Tom?
Yes. And my objection to the machines is not, you know, I mean, I have some concerns about them, but my big objection is this is the ultimate commons. You know, I mean, we talk about our parks as the commons and the schools as the commons. The ultimate commons is the vote, and we shouldn't be handing it over to private for-profit corporations. That's my point.
And I share that.
Yeah, okay. Harvey in Harvin or Harvey in L.A.?
Harvin.
Harvin, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Senator. I think more should be made of the fact that 240 bills were passed by the Nancy Pelosi House, and she was vilified all the time by the Republicans, and none of it was passed either by because of the 60% requirement in the Senate. None of those bills were passed. They were either filibustered or stopped by one senator, and I want to know what is going to be done to change that 60% majority. Even if the Democrats win the House and the Senate, this 60% is an awful, tough barrier to get past to get anything done.
Well, Harvin, you're right. It certainly, as a victim of that, and a number of instances, getting 60 votes is very, very hard. What I can tell you is that from an historical perspective, the 60-vote threshold in the past was used very, very rarely. I mean, what comes to mind in a negative way was the use of the filibuster and the extra majority on the part of segregationists who wanted to prevent civil rights legislation. But from an historical point of view, most legislation in the Senate was passed with 51 votes. What we have seen since Obama has been elected is an unprecedented use of the filibuster and the 60-vote threshold. And I think that's something that we have to deal with. Now, and there is work going on trying to figure it out. Minority rights have got to be protected, but they should not be abused, and they clearly are.
Becky in Maple Creek, you're on, and thanks for listening to KGOE. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to bits and pieces of the speech last night, and the president made a comment about only having regulations that protect the worker. And I wanted some reassurance that this isn't a sign that the EPA is going to be attacked or defanged. And I wanted our government to understand that the citizenry is also concerned about protecting the environment.
Right. Well, I think that's what the president was implying. That I remember he used the word making sure that kids don't get exposed to mercury. The good news, I mean, you're absolutely right. We live in a society where there are all kinds of chemicals out there that consumers need to be protected from, pesticides out there. We have serious problems with air and water pollution that citizens need to be protected from. And unfortunately, and I have to say this, we have seen in recent months some real retreats with regard to the EPA. Major cuts have already been taking place, and I fear very much that as this super committee does its work, the EPA will be on the chopping block. So your call is exactly right. We want to make sure that our kids are drinking clean water, eating good food. The air we're breathing is healthy. And we have got to maintain strong presence of the EPA and protecting those areas.
Bernie, we just have 50 seconds left for the end of the show. It wouldn't be fair to bring a caller on and not have, you know, them have time to ask or you answer. Summary thoughts for the day.
Well, here's the thoughts. The president laid out a plan, some good features to it, and as I've indicated, some features that, in my view, are not so good. I don't like raiding the Social Security Trust Fund payroll tax. I'm concerned about what he means by reforms of Medicare and Medicaid. On the other hand, investing in infrastructure, bringing our teachers back is the right thing. Now is the time for the American people to get involved in this debate, to make sure that we pass a significant piece of legislation which begins to put millions of our people back to work.
Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
That's it.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, as always.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program today, Friday. Anything Goes Friday. Of course, it's more than just Anything Goes. Last night, the president gave a speech, and the first hour being Brunch with Bernie, it's really rare that people, in fact, I don't know of any other opportunities that Americans have to literally call a United States senator and ask any question on any topic for an hour. So I tried to get out of the way. So I have not yet shared with you my thoughts or observations on last night's speech from the president, and would like to do so briefly before we get into, you know, just basically opening the phone lines like we typically do on Fridays. And and by the way, at the beginning of the next hour, Anthony DePalma is going to be with us briefly. He's the author, journalist, and he's the author of a new book, City of Dust, Illness, Arrogance, and 9/11, about, I think the title says it. So anyhow, that'll be an hour from now. But the president gave, I think, what in many ways was an extraordinary speech, and it was an extraordinary speech in as much as it pushed back on an old message. And Jacob, you've got my marked up copy of the speech. If Chris or somebody could bring it in here and hand it to me. Oh, I've got it. I don't know where it went. I will find it as we speak. It's here someplace. Here it is. I've got it right here. Text to President's speech. And here's the point. I've been using this phrase for a couple of weeks now on the radio and on television about the social compact. Now, frankly, I haven't heard anybody use the phrase social compact, you know, since William F. Buckley, in decades. But I was delighted to hear that word in the president's speech last night. And this concept that the compact that we had between the government that we ourselves created, it's not a them out there. It's not like, you know, a dictatorship or Mugabe Zimbabwe or a bureaucracy run amok like the old Soviet Union. It is, in the United States of America, it is we the people. We created this government. And we elect the representatives. And if enough of us participate, and tragically enough of us don't, but if enough of us, we've got 48% voting rate in this country. We're at the bottom of the pile. I mean, Australia is 98% because they require it, but Austria is 91%. They don't require it. So people are very involved. But in any case, we have had without going into the history of the late 18th and the entire 19th century, and let's just talk about the 20th century and the 21st century. We have had basically since the 1930s, until the 1980s, a social compact, a contract between the government and the people who created it, that said, and by the way, this was created by demand of the people. They rejected Herbert Hoover and the Republican policy of doing nothing in response to the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover's Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, famously said, liquidate everything, liquidate labor, liquidate the capital, you know, let it all, eventually it'll all shake out. I'm paraphrasing, but probably badly, but that's the essence of what he said. Basically, don't do anything. Eventually the system will right itself. Well, in the meantime, a lot of people actually literally died. I mean, people were literally dying in the late 20s and early 30s as the result of the Great Depression. And not so much from, you know, kwashiorkor, you know, big belly starvation like you see in Africa during these famines, not just Africa, in Bangladesh and other places. Not so much that, but from the diseases of poverty, from crime, from mental illness, from suicide, from homicide, from broken families, people's lives were destroyed. And children were destroyed in as much as they were growing up malnourished and their brains weren't developing properly. And there was this whole, the consequences of a widespread, massive unemployment and poverty are incredibly destructive to a society. So in 1932, in the election of 1932, the American people said, we want Franklin Roosevelt because he says that he's going to create a contract, a compact with the American people that says, yes, government can do something. Government can be a solution to our problems. Government can help the situation. And that solution held through the Democratic presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, 4 terms he was elected to, through Harry Truman's 2 terms, or term and a half, through Dwight Eisenhower's 2 terms, Republican, through Jack Kennedy's half a term, through Lyndon Johnson's term and a half, through Richard Nixon's term and a half. Even during Nixon's time, there was no questioning that one of the important roles of government was to make sure that there was a middle class in America. And therefore, we had trade policies that kept cheap that basically prevented American laborers from having to compete with people who were literally earning $2 a day or living on a living standard of $2 a day, you know, a couple hundred bucks a year, which is half the planet. 3 billion people right now live on less than $2 a day. And the vast majority of them are more than willing to take an American's job for very, very little. So we had this social through the Nixon administration, through the Ford administration, through the Carter administration. Through that entire period of time, through that roughly 50-year period of time, from the 1930s to the 1980s, we had this compact, this social compact in America between the people and the government that said the government is going to make sure that the middle class actually is a middle class and is not the working poor. And then the New Deal, when Reagan came into office, was replaced with what I call the raw deal. Actually, one of our callers called in yesterday or the day before and suggested that phrase. I love it. And I'm going to use it. I'm going to continue using it. I think it's marvelous. It's brilliant. And I don't remember the name of the caller, but thank you for that. It should have been self-evident. It should have been obvious to all of us a long time ago. And the raw deal that Ronald Reagan proposed was, you're on your own. 401ks, IRAs, you're on your own for your retirement. You're on your own for your health insurance. We're gonna change the laws so that states can't require that health insurance companies be not-for-profit. So we saw this explosion of this for-profit health insurance industry. You're on your own there. Just basically, you're on your own. And the consequence of 30 years of the raw deal that we've had since Reagan came into office is that the billionaires have gotten vastly richer. The 400 people in America own more wealth than the bottom 150 million of us. Billionaires have gotten vastly more richer. Working people have seen their incomes decline during this period of time. And productivity has increased to the point that corporations, and particularly banksters, but even the manufacturing corporations left in America, corporations are more profitable now than they've been in decades. And what President Obama said last night was basically that he was pushing back on the raw deal. Now, I'll give you, after the break, I'll give you all of my arguments about why he didn't push back hard enough, but I think he pushed back brilliantly. And whether, and there is a political danger here, too, for him and for the Republicans that I want to talk about after the break as well. But regardless of the details, in my mind, the big story is the meme.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The big story is that last night President Obama said government can do things. We have since Lincoln, and we will again.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better.
Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and whoops, anything goes Friday, 20 minutes past the hour. Let me share with you just, this is cut number six, Jacob. This is a rather long one, actually, but this is where, again, setting aside the details, I thought it should have been a $1 trillion plan. I thought the president should have thrown it in the Republicans' face and said, I dare you. He did to a large extent. And, well, I'll talk about the politics of it afterwards. I think the far more important thing is the social consequences, the societal, the culture of America itself. That from Reagan through Bush, even Clinton bought into this. He said, you know, the era of big government is over and we're ending welfare as we know it. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, they basically were proposing the raw deal. I mean, Clinton did a lot of very good things. I don't mean to be trashing Bill Clinton here. But the point is that he never really pushed back on that idea that government can be a force for good, aggressively, publicly, changing the storyline of our country. And here is where President Obama did last night. Clip number six, Jacob.
Yes, we are rugged individuals. Yes, we are strong and self-reliant. And it has been the drive and initiative of our workers and entrepreneurs that has made this economy the engine and the envy of the world. But there's always been another thread running throughout our history, a belief that we're all connected and that there's some things we can only do together as a nation. We all remember Abraham Lincoln as the leader who saved our union, founder of the Republican Party. But in the middle of a civil war, he was also a leader who looked to the future. A Republican president who mobilized government to build the Transcontinental Railroad, launch the National Academy of Sciences, set up the first land-grant colleges. And leaders of both parties have followed the example he set. Ask yourselves, where would we be right now if the people who sat here before us decided not to build our highways, not to build our bridges, our dams, our airports? What would this country be like if we had chosen not to spend money on public high schools or research universities or community colleges? Millions of returning heroes, including my grandfather, had the opportunity to go to school because of the GI Bill. Where would we be if they hadn't had that chance?
See, this is, I think that was the most important part of the speech. And the reason why is because what he's saying is, we're not buying the raw deal. Now, the details of what he's proposing, let's cut some programs so that we can do these other programs and all this, we'll see how it works out. And I'm frankly skeptical that it's going to produce a radical change in America. The fact of the matter is that there's no way the Republicans in Congress would allow it to. So he's threading this needle. But in my mind, the most important part of the speech is the fact that he is changing the conversation, the political conversation. This is the real battle. When Joe Coors and Richard Mellon Scaife and the Koch brothers and all these other guys got together back in the day and said, you know, let's fund the Heritage Foundation, let's fund the Cato Institute, let's fund these right-wing think tanks, Let's get out the message that government is bad. They began that aggressively in the 1970s. It was picked up by the President of the United States of America in the 1980s. We had a president. Actually, we had two of them, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. We had two presidents who actually ran on the platform of being against the government that they were saying they wanted to lead. I mean, do you realize how bizarre that is? Ronald Reagan saying this?
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
I mean, it's like, yes, we created this nation and people fought and died for it, but it's the problem. We need to get government out of the way so we can put Goldman Sachs in charge of our Social Security. We need to get government out of the way. This is the other half of the sentence that the Republicans don't fill in when they do these slogans. We need to get government out of the way so we can put United Healthcare in charge of our health care. We need to get government out of the way so we can put Dow Chemical in charge of whether or not your water is clean. We need to get government out of the way so that we can put the Coke oil industries in charge of whether or not your air is pure. We need to get government out of the way so that we can make the manufacturers in China in charge of whether or not your children are being poisoned by chemicals in the toys that they chew on and play with. We need to get government out of the way so that ConAgra and Cargill can decide whether or not your food is going to be safe and what quality of food it's going to be and how it's going to be labeled and what you're going to know about it. We need to get government out of the way so that the auto manufacturers can decide whether or not your car is going to be safe. And this is where he was pushing back on this. Cut number 7, Jacob, of the president, if you can quickly pull it up. It's a short one.
No single individual built America on their own. We built it together. We have been and always will be one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, a nation with responsibilities to ourselves and with responsibilities to one another. And members of Congress, it is time for us to meet our responsibilities.
Do you see that? I mean, this is the exact opposite of the Reagan message. Now, again, I could tell you, my specific criticisms of it, but I don't think that they're all that important. I think that what's going to happen, well, I'll share with you my thoughts on the politics after this, and then we'll pick up your calls. I'd love to know whether you think I've gone into la-la land here on this. What I see is that there is an opportunity here, that the Republicans have an opportunity to either win or lose big. And the president also. I'll explain right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then, of course, we'll take your calls. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Of course, it's the day after the president's speech Friday, too. And 9/11's coming up this week. It goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Okay, real quickly, here's my political take on what happened last night. The president basically said, let's extend unemployment benefits. Let's put some people back to work. Let's put some money into the states. Let's stimulate the economy. Now, it's a stimulus that might produce a 1 or 2% bump in GDP, which may get unemployment down below 7%, and, which means that it would be less of a problem for him going into the election. As I already said, I think all of those details have to do with basically the election and the fact that Republicans control the House of Representatives, and so he's got to do this kind of sideways dance to get anything passed. And that I think that, frankly, he's 3 years too late on this, that this should have been job one. But I'm not going to fault him for that. It's easy to misread. And certainly, given the economic advisors he had, Lawrence Summers and whatnot, in the early days, to misread whether a recession is a recession or a Great Depression. Although I was pretty outspoken about this is the Depression, but nonetheless. But the politics of it, if the Republicans last night had said what they're really thinking, which is, hello, remember that John Boehner quote? You know, the Democrats want this, hello. If the Republicans had said that last night, and they had held that position until November 2012, then Barack Obama would have, it would have been a perfect replay of the election in 1948, where Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Congress, because the Congress, in the election of 46, the Republicans took control of both the Senate and the House for the first time in a generation. And Harry Truman ran against them. And there, the Republicans of that day said the same thing as John Boehner here said just, you know, a few months ago.
Hell no, you can't!
Hell no, you can't. Okay, so that's what they wanted to say last night. But they knew that if they said that, they would be handing the presidency to President Obama, no matter what the economy was like. And that's the bet that President Obama was making, was, you know, he puts forward this offer, and if they don't take it, he's going to win. Now, if they do take it in whole, he will probably also win. And the Republicans know this, because it will put people back to work, and it will change the zeitgeist in America, and it will reveal that the whole Tea Party notion that government is the problem and not the solution is insanity, and that government can do things in the United States of America, good things, as the president said last night. So if they don't take the deal, they lose. If they do take the deal, they lose. So what will the Republicans do? My bet is they will speak out of one side of their mouth and act out of the other. That, well, actually, they'll kind of split the difference. What they're going to do is, they're, as last night, you heard Eric Cantor saying, well, yeah, you know, there's some good things in here. It's time for us to start working together. So they're going to start behaving like the adults in the room. And then they're going to actually, when it gets down to the legislation, particularly with this Gang of 12, you had John Kyle last night, who's on the Gang of 12, saying to the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, as I recall, to these two right-wing think tanks, Heritage is one of them, I think AEI was the other, saying that if this committee wants to keep on talking about cutting defense spending, he's going to quit. I thought everything was on the table. Apparently not for John Kyle. Anyhow, if what the Republicans do is they say, okay, we will cut the programs, but we're not going to give you the jobs. We're not going to give you the stimulus. If the president holds firm against that and says, I'm not going to compromise, this is the deal, it's the American Jobs Act, take it or leave it. If he holds firm on that, he will win in 2012. But if he compromises, or if he caves in and takes half a deal, I think there's a very good chance he'll be a one-term president. So the next 13, 14 months are going to be very, very, very interesting. Because make no mistake about it, what you saw last night was not only the response to an economic crisis, it was also the opening salvo in the presidential campaign of 2012. So, anyhow, those are my thoughts on it. Let's pick up your thoughts. 866-97-THOM. Sean in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, I have to admit, it's a little upsetting listening to you, only because what seems so transparently obvious to me, that since the end of the Cold War, both Republicans and Democrats have engaged in a rollback of all the popular gains for poor and working class people.
That's what I've been saying, that starting in 1980, it's not even since the end of the Cold War, it was before the end of the Cold War, it was really 81. Since 81, when Reagan busted PATCO, we basically saw the Reagan Revolution was real. And we saw the end of the New Deal and the beginning of what I'm calling the raw deal. And it has not stopped to this day.
But at least you had the Democratic Party, even though Reagan was the president, the Democratic Party was at least putting up a fight. But it seemed like when the Berlin Wall came down, you had this wholesale sellout. You had you know, the Bill Clinton phenomenon, or like Chris Hedges, you know, the brilliant author, talks about how when NAFTA was implemented, he had to leave the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
For me, it was when people like Stephen Solar supported the first Gulf War. You know, you had Democrats actually joining Republicans to start the first Gulf War. So how did we get to a place, Tom, where the pragmatic, shrewd adult in the room is the one who's repealing regulations on smog and is literally going to kill sick people and children?
Yeah.
How did we get there?
We
and
got
that's
there.
It's so upsetting to me to listen to you because I know you're more intelligent than that. You have your own motivations for standing up for the president, but it's very upsetting to listen to.
My primary motivation for standing up to the president, to the extent that what I'm doing is that the Supreme Court is a more powerful institution than the presidency, and it is at stake. And no matter what I may think of President Obama, I know that the balance of the Supreme Court is going to be decided by the next presidential election, and that is going to determine what kind of nation we live in for the next generation or two. And that concerns me greatly. I'll just put that right on the table. That is probably 80% of my entire motivation. I think President Obama's a decent man. I think he's a smart guy. I think deep down inside he wants to do the right thing. He's trapped in a system, particularly as a result of Citizens United, where he can't do the right thing very often. The smog thing is an example. I've given him no pass on it. I think it's horrible. I think it was a bad deal.
The free trade agreements, the same thing.
And the Panama part of the free trade agreement is just so that what's the principal business that they do in Panama? Secret banking in the Western Hemisphere.
And Colombia murders its labor organizers.
Right.
It's just
right. I mean, these are insane deals, and I'm wholly opposed to that.
Appointing Supreme Court justices, though.
Yes.
The guy that repeals smog regulation
is
pushing for free trade agreements.
Yes. Because I don't want Mitt Romney appointing Supreme Court justices, because the Supreme Court justices are the ones who set the table, who basically establish the rules by which presidential elections are done, by determining who can contribute money and who can't, and how much money they can put into this political system, and whether or not free speech equals money, and whether or not corporations are people. And that is right now the big issue that nobody is talking about in the mainstream media. Nobody will. Because these are big corporations and they're claiming personhood. You will not hear that discussed on any of the corporate media unless it's just, you know, jokingly or in passing. You will not hear on any of the corporate media, liberal, conservative, I don't care what it is, you won't hear a discussion, an honest discussion about free trade agreements. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to hear an honest discussion about the role of transnational corporations in America who make most of their money outside the United States. You will not hear an honest discussion about how repatriation of that money, which is the phrase that everybody uses, nobody is ever challenged on, is basically a way of saying to these corporations, more than 60% of all American trade, international trade, setting aside oil, more than 60% of all international trade is within the same company.
But you're saying all the people that have been arrested down at the White House over the last 2 weeks, the 350.org people, they don't get your insight about the Supreme Court? I don't understand.
I'm absolutely with them. I don't think that the 350.org people are trying to take down the Obama presidency. I think that the 350.org people, they're wearing Obama 808 buttons. I think that there's a very good chance, particularly given some of the high-profile people who got arrested there, the 1,200 people who got arrested there, and the way that Bill McKibben has handled this down the middle. I had a half-hour conversation with him about this last Friday on television, that the way that they've handled this is to, in all probability, cause the president to push this thing back until after the election, when he won't have that enormous pressure of having to raise money on him. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. If he goes along with it, I will be very disappointed.
What threshold has to be crossed, Tom, before people give up on Democrats appointing Supreme Court justices? I mean,
the threshold that has to be crossed is the percentage of us, the number of us, who show up in the Democratic Party and say, yes, I'd like to be a committee person. Have you ever showed up at a local Democratic Party meeting?
As a member, well, I was with Democratic Socialists of America 20 years ago. Carol Moseley Braun was running for the Senate, and I supported her campaign.
Supporting a campaign is a different thing from saying, I'm going to be part of this party. I'm going to take the damn thing over. This is what the Tea Party did to the Republicans, and it's why they have over 100 members in the House of Representatives right now, and they're the tail that's wagging the dog. We should be doing the same thing in the Democratic Party. And until we do, we got no right to complain. Thank you for the call. But that's what we have to do. And, you know, we can sit around all day long and say, you know, the president's not perfect enough, or this congressman isn't perfect enough. We have to become the people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service for just a quick update on what's going on in the world and more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Jim in Somerdale, Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind? Oh, hey, Jim, I'm sorry. I've got Talk Radio News on the line. I'll get back to your call, Jim. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
My apologies.
Okay.
So you're at the White House.
I am.
So what's going on?
Well, of course, there's a lot of reaction to the president's speech last night, and of course, the president took it on the road to Richmond, Virginia today.
Uh-huh.
I think not coincidentally, Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader's district, and Eric Cantor himself will be giving a speech a little bit later on today. The president really reiterated what he said last night as he talked about the American Jobs Act and jobs, and they need to pass this bill. And I've just been listening to you, and clearly some of it you agree with and some of it you don't agree with. And there are reactions and some interesting Democratic reactions. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, lashed out at the Tea Party today as much as Harry Reid can lash out, and he ripped Tea Party Republicans' radical agenda, calling on centrist Republicans to join Democrats in passing Obama's job plans, saying we must not continue to bow to the Tea Party Republicans, willing to do anything to hurt the president. We cannot allow their radical agenda to crowd out America's jobs agenda. And Representative John Larson, Connecticut, who's the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, went even further, in fact, because he's basically saying that they should not go for the piecemeal strategy, which is really what Eric Cantor was talking about last night, which was that they may take pieces of the American Jobs Act, but not pass the entire thing. He says that's a punt. The public perceives that as kicking their can down the road and not stepping up. What's the problem with voting it up or down? And then he was asked, well, if there has to be a bit that you vote on, what should it be? And he said, infrastructure. Take it right to the floor tomorrow.
Yeah. And my position on this has been that if the president compromises with the Republicans, he's lost. He's going to be badly, badly hurt. And if he refuses to compromise and he holds firm on this and says, pass this and, you know, take up or down, yes or no, I want it now, then even if he doesn't get it, he's won because he's called them out. He's exposed them. And I just, you know, hope that he takes this whole thing. And it sounds like Harry Reid is saying that. Others are saying that. And Eric Cantor and the Republicans are all doing a really nice job of kind of wiggling around and trying to say, oh, we're just as reasonable as the president. We just don't like, you know, we just don't like some parts of it. It's like the old FDR, you know, they all love Social Security. They just want to change it a little, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's interesting you say that because the conventional wisdom in Washington today is that economic reality being what it is and political reality being what it is, that the president would get a win even if he only gets a dollar more than half of what he's after.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes, that's what they're thinking. And it was noticeable, I think, that he never said how many jobs his plan would create, and he didn't say what it would do to the unemployment rate, which was smart.
Yeah, yeah. That 8% number has haunted him. I mean, that's been the Republic. Even though he never said he was going to get unemployment down to 8%, two of his advisors did, and they have shoved those words into his mouth as if he said them. Just like Al Gore never said he invented the internet, he said he co-sponsored the legislation that created the internet, which is true. But the Republicans have just done a marvelous job of reinventing history on this, and they'll do it again.
Wall Street, however, was not excited. Wall Street has dropped overall. It's partly to do with Europe.
I think it's mostly to do with Europe.
Well, I think a good bit of it's to do with Europe, but they've been talking to analysts, one chief market analyst is saying it's partly the fall of the euro against the dollar, but also he said that one Clark Yinks today said the market just doesn't believe that it is going to be passed by that Republican House.
Very interesting.
Yeah. They believe that there is intransigence in Washington, D.C.
Right, which is basically why S&P downgraded us.
Precisely that. Precisely one of the two reasons why we were downgraded by S&P and why Moody's has us on a watch list.
Yeah. Okay.
Meantime, on the terrorism threat, Hillary Rodham Clinton, the Secretary of State, said this morning, appearing at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, that Al-Qaeda is behind what officials have described as a possible car bomb attack. She says, mentioning the specific, credible, but unconfirmed report that Al-Qaeda, again, is seeking to harm Americans and, in particular, to target New York and Washington.
Right.
What I have heard via a source who has a very close source close to this, this is the real deal.
Yeah, the real threat or a real probability of it actually happening.
This is a real threat. This isn't one of those where, yeah, this could be something, but, you know, it's probably not anything. No, they think that there are three guys. They think there are three guys who came into the country. They think this is real.
Wow. Okay.
So there is real concern about this. And very briefly, in Syria, thousands of Syrian protesters today appealed for international help in the face of the bloody government crackdown. And this is a real shift. Now, they're not asking for NATO to come in and do bomb strikes. What they seem to be asking for is observation missions, human rights monitors who could help deter attacks on civilians. They were shouting in cities all across the country, we want international protection. Yeah, very interesting. Meantime,
so Bashir is continuing the crackdown and he's continuing to murder his own people.
Absolutely. Even to the extent we're hearing today that yesterday security forces forcibly removed patients from a hospital and prevented doctors from reaching the wounded during a military siege in Homs this week.
Amazing. Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thank you for the update, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. We will be back, Anything Goes Friday, here on the Tom Hartman Program, with your calls, your thoughts. What did the president really say last night? How's it going to play out? What are the Republicans going to do? You know, which chess piece has been moved here?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Anthony DePalma is on the line with us. He is the author. He's an author, journalist, writer in residence at Seton Hall University, former New York Times correspondent who covered 9/11 health issues, and the author of City of Dust, Illness, Arrogance, and 9/11, the website ProPublica.org. Am I pronouncing that right, Anthony?
ProPublica.
Publica. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. The anglicized version, I guess. tell us I remember all the controversy around Christine Todd Whitman saying, you know, everything's fine, go down there, help out. And then later in 2007, I think you write about how she testified before Congress that was the right thing to do and say. What's the real story of what the Ground Zero workers were exposed to?
Right from the beginning, but in the seconds after those buildings came down, there were many people in New York, officials, doctors, emergency responders, who knew that that dust was harmful. But there was also a real urge and an important movement to get the city back on its feet. So you ended up with a real conflict there between the rush to reopen and the need to safeguard the health of the people who were going to be down there.
Well, wasn't there a third dimension, too, and that is that there may be still some people alive or there may be people trapped in nearby buildings? And we need to
At the beginning, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. For 2 weeks at least, it was a rescue operation.
Right.
So the people on the pile were working desperately to see if they could find anyone there who was still alive. But remember, Lower Manhattan is not just the 16 acres of Ground Zero. There are thousands of apartments, people with kids and parents who live there. There are schools, and there are many, many offices. All of that was closed for the first couple of days. Mm-hmm. By the following Monday, everyone was urged to go back. And at that time, what these documents that ProPublica has put up on its website for everyone to look at, you can go right through them yourself and see the emails and the other documents. What they show is that there was a concerted effort to reassure people that it was okay, even when either the evidence from those early test samples suggested that there was concern, reason to be concerned, or there wasn't enough data to make any statement at all. And they just went ahead and did it in order to bring this sense of normalcy back to the city.
This seems like a fundamental breach of the contract between the government and its people that of integrity and honesty, if nothing else. You know, even those super right wingers who would say the government's job is not to protect the people, I think would agree that the government's job should be at least to inform the people.
That really is at the heart of this. If we're looking not just at what happened 10 years ago, but what our policy ought to be in the light of disasters like this. When you have a conflicting goal, reopen Wall Street and get the city back on its feet, which is a worthy goal, and protecting the health and the safety of people, how do you do both of those things at the same time? I don't think it has to be either or. But look at this, Tom, as an example of what we found. By Friday of that first week, right, there was dust everywhere. The administration in Washington was pushing to reopen Wall Street as quickly as possible. The decision was made, let's reopen on Monday. Right? So that's important to do. The EPA sent down vacuum trucks to actually vacuum the streets of Lower Manhattan, where they knew there had to be asbestos and lots of other things because we knew what was in the buildings.
Sure.
They sent those trucks out. For 5 days, those trucks were vacuuming up the streets, and the EPA found out that they had the wrong filters. So they didn't equip the trucks with the proper filter, the high-efficiency particulate filter.
The HEPA filters.
That would take the HEPA filter, exactly. That would take asbestos out of the air.
So they were basically just recycling it. They were just fanning it around.
Which makes it worse, because asbestos is dangerous when it's in the air. So
right.
If you move it around that way. They knew about that. They never leveled with people. They were continued to tell people to go back to work. It was only a year later, during an investigation by the Inspector General of the EPA, that the information came out. In these documents, the officials at the EPA, particularly the communications office, are asked, was there ever any discussion about telling people that those trucks had the wrong filter? And the spokeswoman couldn't recall that there was such a discussion. And in fact, there wasn't, because they never did actually announce it.
Now, this was the Bush administration's EPA. How
Yes.
high up in the administration did this decision go? And is it, you know, were laws broken? I mean, is it criminal what happened?
Well, there have been lawsuits and investigations, and no one has been convicted of anything. No one has been charged with anything. The lawsuits against Christy Whitman were eventually dropped. But how far up did it go? What we have here is a situation where the people in New York at the EPA were basically forced to send all of their communications to the White House first before information could be given out to people. So the White House basically, through the Council on Environmental Quality, scrubbed the statements that Christy Whitman was making before she made them.
Wow.
And so there are lots of instances in these documents where the EPA in New York in Region 2 was about to say to people, look, we found disconcertingly high levels of asbestos on Water Street.
Right.
Water Street not far from Wall Street.
Right.
Lots of offices down there. And we think it's a particular concern to office workers. The Council on Environmental Quality says, no, I think that goes too far. I suggest you drop that. not only is it dropped, but when the release actually comes out the day before people return to work, instead of a warning that there's high levels of asbestos on Water Street, the OSHA head says, I encourage you to go back to work.
Well, and geez, my dad was exposed to asbestos in the late 40s, early 50s, and died of mesothelioma, asbestos-induced lung cancer, in the 1990s. I mean, there's a long lag period. Was that the kind of thinking that, they, you know, hey, these people aren't going to get sick and die for 20, 30, 40 years, so what the hell? I mean, was it that crass?
Yeah, there's no evidence that was the case. They knew that there was asbestos down there. Here's another example of the kind of situation they were in and how they responded to it. We basically do not have standards for asbestos in the open air. So when they were doing their sampling, they were applying to the test samples of the dust that was in the air and the dust that was found on the ledges and on cars around Ground Zero. They were using a standard that is not really an environmental standard, but a standard.
Workplace standard?
A workplace standard, which says any material that has more than 1% asbestos in it is considered asbestos-containing material and can only be removed or handled with proper training and proper certification.
Right, and you.
So that's like the tiles on your office floor, or the ceiling tiles, or the pipes in your basement if they're wrapped with insulation.
And they were finding up to 3%, weren't they?
Yeah, they were in some of those early samples. But look at the way they presented that to the public. Instead of saying 3%, three times the trigger.
Did Rudy Giuliani know about this? About these lies?
I'm sorry?
Did Rudy Giuliani know about these lies, the mayor?
It's hard to know exactly what he knew at that time, because these are federal officials who were reporting, but we assume that they were reporting to the city Department of Health,
right,
and the city DEP, and they were reporting to Giuliani. Giuliani continued with the same message, which was, don't worry about it, go back to work.
Don't worry, be happy. Yeah. Amazing. Anthony DePalma, you can find it over at ProPublica.org. He is the author of City of Dust, Illness, Arrogance, and 9/11. Extraordinary work. Anthony, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. And just to remind your listeners that they can see those documents on that site.
Yeah, you got it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, check it out at ProPublica.org. You can actually see the documents. We'll be back. Anything Goes Friday. Your calls. So here it is. By the way, this Sunday, today's Friday, Sunday is 9/11. It's the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And they say that Al-Qaeda is planning an attack on D.C., so I'm going to be here. and Chris is going to be here. Jacob is going to be here. And we're going to be doing a live show from on Sirius XM Radio and on Free Speech TV from 7 and from 4 until 7 o'clock Eastern Time. 4 to 7 Eastern Time. And it will also be streaming live on our website at tomhartman.com. Just a quick heads up. It'll be a 9/11 call-in show. That's going to be the topic of the show. And hosted jointly by SiriusXM Radio, Free Speech TV, What's the Legacy of 9/11? And, of course, you can call into the show at 866-987-THOM then and, of course, right now. So your thoughts. Ray in Larkspur. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, I really appreciate your analysis of the speech, and I hope that you'll maybe find the time to put something similar on Common Dreams.
Yeah, that's one of my goals for this weekend is to write it up. I haven't had time to.
Yeah, it really struck me. You know, you've been my mentor, and I've gone to learn about Teddy Roosevelt. I've listened to his book about. It's really amazing how the first Patriots put the Union together, and then there you had Jackson and Lincoln keep it together, and then Teddy Roosevelt was the one who really stimulated all the progressive, and that government can help people, and it's really the job you've been.
And then Franklin made it law.
And of course we've had the pushback ever since. And I want to tell you, I'm a dentist, and I hand out a little different than your dental experience. I've been handing out your Common Dreams article on Jude Winiski.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, there's a typo in it. I got to fix.
You opened up such doors for me on Jude Winiski, the Powell memo, and Smedley Darlington Butler.
Yeah, thank you. That's the other thing. I made a list for myself this weekend. I want to rewrite the Jude Winiski thing because I said that I forget. I had the wrong. I think I said that LBJ was running against Nixon in 68, and of course it was Hubert Humphrey. And it was one of those articles that I dashed off quickly, and it's everything remains on the internet forever. And I need to do a new version of it that is minus the typo, because you can't go back and fix the old ones. But in any case, thank you. Was there a question in there, Ray?
I'm a very strong Obama supporter. I've been a dedicated Obama supporter, and I have great hope that he's really going to hold tight. This guy, his pedigree is pretty solid.
Well, here's the thing: He will only hold strong if enough Americans stand behind him. If we do the same thing that we did in 2010 and say, we got the historic president, he's a good guy, he could talk well, the Democrats all over the House, I think I'll watch sports. If we do that, then he's not going to be able to hold strong. It's just the political reality. This power flows from the bottom up to some extent in the United States. I absolutely acknowledge the horror of power flowing from the top down, the Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers and whatnot, but it also flows from the bottom up, and that's us, and we've got to get out there and we've got to get active. So anyhow, Ray, thanks a lot for your call. I appreciate it and your kind words. Richard in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Good, Tom. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was watching on the internet. I was catching up on some Jon Stewart shows. I don't have cable, so
mm-hmm.
Buddy Romo was on. Now I've heard of this guy, but
he was
I
on
really
our show here
know.
About 3 weeks ago.
The girl took my call. I mentioned that, mm-hmm. and I didn't know much about him. And he was a governor of Louisiana. He was also a congressperson,
mm-hmm.
and he's running for president of the United States. And
as a Republican,
real quick. Yes. And let me just read this quote really quick. It's a special interest, John, who write the tax code. You can't read it. It doesn't work for America. It hurts jobs. We give them away, and they're being stolen by unfair trade. And nobody does anything.
Right.
You know why? Corporations have never made
this
more
is,
money.
You know, Richard, the reason, in my opinion, the reason why Buddy Romer's campaign will never get any traction and will never go anywhere is because he is willing to talk about trade. Even Ron Paul doesn't talk about protectionism. Ron Paul is in favor of free trade. Ron Paul thinks that transnational corporations should be writing the rules about how the United States conducts trade with other countries. And therefore, he's allowed a seat in the table. But if you start talking like Ross Perot, you're out.
Yeah, that was my feeling, because I'm thinking, well, why isn't this legitimate candidate amongst the debate? And then I was thinking to myself, well, if Republicans, if you talk to a Republican, one-on-one, you can hear their mind just shut off. You can hear the click when you start talking about anything progressive or anything that's fair. And I was thinking, well, geez, if they heard this from a Republican, maybe they would start listening.
Yeah. Yeah, it's entirely possible. It's one of the reasons we had him on. I think it's probably why Jon Stewart had him on. I didn't see the interview. I've got it recorded at home, and maybe this weekend I'll have the time. But
just felt like he was a very, very decent guy.
Yeah, Buddy Romer is a decent guy. But keep in mind, he's a Republican.
Exactly. That's not my point. My point was it's keeping Republicans from hearing these talking points.
Yeah.
Where they might actually listen to some of it.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. There are, they'll let Ron Paul go off on ending the war. They'll let him go off on ending the drug war because they know that, actually, this is another example. I said it earlier, Obama's going to wimp out on this thing unless we push him. And we have to be there. And any congressman, or woman, any member of the Senate would or will. They have to have a constituency behind them. They have to have the people behind them. And not as a circular firing squad, as a wind pushing them. I think that this is Ron Paul's the greatest example of this. The Republican Party can't ignore him because he has such a large following. He came in number 2 in the straw poll. Fox News refused to mention his name for the first hour and a half. They're all trying to pretend he doesn't exist. but they can't ignore him. They can't lock him out. It was the same thing with Dennis Kucinich in the Democratic Party last time around. And because he has a large constituency, a large following, there's a lot of people who really love him, who know that he is speaking the truth. But there are some truths, like the free trade truth. You know, that, you know, Buddy Romer says that, he's out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly in your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. The bad and the very, very pectinately ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. The Ohio Supreme Court. After several death row sentences were commuted over the last few months, the High Court has commissioned a task force to review the death penalty in Ohio to make sure it is, in their words, administered in the most fair, efficient, and judicious manner possible. While Ohio's Chief Justice said the court does not plan to abolish the death penalty just yet, this is at least an acknowledgement that the ultimate punishment in the land is wrought with problems. And unlike Rick Perry, who applauds death, the Ohio High Court is taking the matter very seriously. The bad. Congressman Jeff Landry. Unlike some of his other colleagues on the right, the Republican from Louisiana did attend President Obama's job speech last night. However, he did check his respect for the president at the door. Throughout the entire speech, Congressman Landry held up signs reading, "Drilling equals jobs." Of course, drilling also equals pollution, ecological devastation, lack of innovation, and death, as we saw in the case of the BP oil spill. But all that aside, would it kill the Republicans just for once to welcome the president into Congress without calling him a liar or upstaging him with some bogus sign? Thank you, Congressman Landry, for once again confirming who the adult in the room is. And the very, very ugly war criminal George W. Bush. In an interview with USA Today, the failed president once again tried to take credit for the killing of Osama bin Laden, saying, "The work that was done by intelligence communities during my presidency was part of putting together the puzzle that enabled us to see the full picture of how bin Laden was communicating and eventually where he was hiding." Well, turns out that's not true. In fact, while he was president, Bush deliberately devoted resources away from finding bin Laden to instead go to war with Iraq, an illegal war that we're still fighting today. Now that the Bush presidency is over, the rewrite is just beginning, and it's very, very ugly. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. And Devin in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Devin, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call today.
Sure.
Well, I really wanted to latch on to the whole concept there that the EPA is willing to look the other way when, you know, when the environment and the people in it are being screwed.
Yeah, I have a horrible feeling the same thing happened with Katrina, or I'm sorry, with the BP Gulf spill down in the Gulf.
Yeah, the same thing's happening
with this administration. You know,
Well, with this administration, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's part of the problem that, you know, there's Jackson has been quoted as saying that EPA is not a placebo. But if you really look at what they do in some parts of the country, certainly what happened on 9/11 and the months thereafter, they were negligent. But
yeah.
Under this administration, EPA is also looking the other way when it comes to contamination from the military. I mentioned our Facebook page, Environmental Advocates of the New River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I put a document up there this morning that talks about the harmonization of EPA and DOD.
Right.
And this is from a meeting that was held in 2008.
Doesn't DOD have a bunch of exemptions from EPA regulations?
Yeah.
Don't they basically operate under their own rules?
It seems that they make the rules.
No, I thought legally that they had an exemption from EPA rules.
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm not advocating
for that. I think it would be a horrible thing. But that's what I'm glad I'm wrong.
It could be worse. Right, yeah. Right. They're, depending on what, you know, what we're talking about, like the perchlorate at the open burning grounds underneath that site is perchlorate and carbon tetrachloride in the groundwater. Now, they've chosen to use a standard adopted in the state of Tennessee at Oak Ridge Labs of 26 parts per billion as their, as what they will accept at this particular location. EPA is proposing to accept it, but the Army, the U.S. Army itself, has proposed in a memo fairly recently 15 parts per billion should be the limit, and certainly that's the point at which, you know, pregnant women should be told not to drink the water, but a test in the last
probably
6 months. One, some states are at one, for sure. Some states are at one. And the latest reading of 147 parts per billion in the groundwater at hazardous waste management.
I've got it. Devin, give us a plug for the website again, and I've got to move along.
The Facebook page is Environmental Advocates of the New River Valley. We're going to go en masse Thursday, September 15th. We're going to meet up at the Easy Chair in Blacksburg, drive to the New River Valley Competitiveness Center, and attend the Radford Army's Restoration Advisory Board en masse.
Okay, good on you. I'm all in favor of grassroots actions. I think it's marvelous what you're doing. Thank you for the call. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Be careful this weekend, please.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what can you do?
Maybe you should have stayed in Portland.
I'm not all that concerned. You know, the reality is more people are killed by lightning in the United States than by terrorists. More people are killed by drunk drivers in a month than have been killed by terrorists in the history of the United States.
Florida's number one for lightning strikes.
Yeah.
Here in Florida.
Yeah, so
I've
Doc
been on the
Flo.
Phone quite a while, but I did want to say that the Commerce Department had new figures on the trade deficit.
Okay.
44.7 billion.
For the month.
It's gone down some, but don't you think that's still pretty high?
Yeah, it should be a positive number, not a negative number. You know, it was for a long, long time. We used to sell things to the world. Now we buy things from the world. It's absolutely wrong. And Flo, it's this and more free trade treaties, as the president is proposing, are not going to get us any, you know, it's not going to help things at all. The South Koreans, you know, he said he'd love to see Chrysler and General Motors selling their cars in South Korea. It ain't going to happen. You know, unless they happen to manufacture them there, it just not. You know, they've you know, all of these various countries, at pretty much except the United States, have figured out ways to protect their own domestic manufacturers. Thanks for the call, Flo. Vaughn in Portland. Hey, Vaughn, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So I was just listening to the president's speech last night, and then they're putting it in the real world, and you know, he wants to spend another $447 billion with it, or trillion, billion dollars with
billion.
It past this. There's not even
half a trillion.
Half a trillion dollars.
Yeah.
And I was speaking with a colleague last night, and he's got a project. He's building a fourplex here in Portland. It's costing him $330,000 is the total cost of the project.
Mm-hmm.
$91,000 of that is in city paid fees, building permits, zoning permits, every permit that you can come up with.
Okay, so Vaughn, let me ask you a question. This fourplex, is this, you mean a theater?
What's that?
This is a fourplex. You mean a theater? Four theaters? Four screen theater?
No, like a tract housing, townhouses.
Townhouses. Okay, great. How does he expect people are going to get to their houses if they don't have to, you know, use public transport, public rights of way, public roads? How does he, you know, what does he think that people are, you know, going to move to Portland? You know, if the standard of living really sucks, if the city, you know, if that $90,000 that he's putting in doesn't go for a better quality of life in the city, you know, and Portland is one of the most regulated and planned cities in America. And it's also one of the cities in America that people have the highest quality of life and most like to live in. So I would submit to you that, you know, you can complain about I'm having to pay $90,000 in permits. He's going to make it back by being able to sell his products, and the proof of it is that he wouldn't be doing it if he wasn't doing it.
Now, interesting you say that, because he's actually losing money on the deal, but he's employing over 250 people by building this project.
And why is he doing the deal if he's losing money on it? Is he an idiot?
No, because of the way that the culture is right now and the environment, he didn't start out losing money when he put it on paper.
Oh, okay. So he put the thing together back before the housing boom busted.
Downturn in the market and the $91,000 that he's got to pay the government in order to build the project. Yeah. He's got another one. He's got a vacant lot up in Northeast that he wants to buy.
Yeah.
The tax bill alone is $19,000 on the vacant lot.
Yeah.
He's been going around with the city for 6 months because they don't want to sell it to him at the price that it's really worth. They want to just sit there. This $19,000 tax bill, collected. Yeah.
Vaughn, my heart is just bleeding for the poor developer and his $91,000. I'm sorry. I'm not, you're not moving me. Chris in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was calling up the president's speech, and I thought he had some good things to say. One of the things I disagree with, and I want to explain why, is the increase in the taxes on corporations. Because in reality, they don't just absorb those taxes and take them out of their bottom line. They pass it on and increase prices to their customers or increase in the cost of services to their customers.
Prove it.
Or they take it away from...
Prove it. In the 1950s, corporations were paying 35% of the cost of government. Right now, they pay 11%. Are you telling me that corporations in America are not taking that extra 20% that used to go to the cost of government so that we could pay lower taxes? You're telling me that they're just reducing the cost of their products? It sure looks to me like they're giving that money to their CEOs and their stockholders.
I'm not finished.
Well, I'm sorry, I am. not to be disrespectful, that's bad. But we're out of time. The machine starts, and I genuinely have no control over that. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Thank you for your call. Call back again. Let's have an intelligent debate about this. Sorry about the time cut.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video producers, Chris Bryant and Eric Hamilton, our phone screener, Julie Lulli, our radar researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our syndicators, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network and DirecTV, to all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and all the others around the country, to Monica Hoshby, Dennis Trunoff, Don Rojas, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is much appreciated. Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling in reference to the woman who asked about military standards for air pollution.
Yes. Well, she didn't. She's. Son, go ahead.
I want to give you some information. My son is a research scientist at Los Alamos National Labs,
mm-hmm.
and he just got a contract to investigate, and he can do this. Right now, what the military does on their training fields is they explode Comp B explosives when they're training, mm-hmm. which are made up of RDX and TNT. RDX, of course, pollutes the water, and TNT, of course, is a carcinogenic material. He will be able to supply the military with chemicals in their explosives, which are not pollutants. This research grant came through the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, which is interagency, but these technologies are related directly to defense.
Hmm.
And the Defense Department would like to do more of this. However, You know, these are bidding contracts. These research scientists have to bid on them, has to go through peer review. They have to make sure the scientists know what they're doing. And then sometimes they get the grants if the money is available.
Right.
The military is very much involved in removing as many carcinogens from their military fields as they can.
Mm-hmm.
So the initials for this organization are SERDP,
mm-hmm.
if you want to check it out. They are limited in their funds, but we do have the research scientists in this country who can help the military, and my son is one of them, and he's working on this grant.
God bless him.
This year, yeah.
That's great. That's great. Thank you, Carol, for that information and for, you know, speaking up and sharing it with us. I very much appreciate it, and thanks. Thanks for watching us there in Charlottesville, Virginia. Tom in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
How are you doing, Tom?
Good.
I enjoyed the show with Bernie, a brunch with Bernie today, and I noticed he mentioned the COLA. I'm a diabetic amputee now for 5 years, and my disability check is the only source of income.
Mm-hmm.
So a COLA increase would really help. Is there a understanding or a law? Because I'm worried that they're going to raise Medicare Part B up this next year, and that's going to wipe out any COLA funding that we might get. Do you have any information on that?
I don't, and I don't think anybody could honestly say that they do, because this is something that Congress has to do, and heaven only knows what Congress is going to be up to. Or, for that matter, I mean, this is an election year. There may even be some Republicans who figure, hey, they got to get reelected, so they'll do things for you know, people who are on Social Security or Social Security disability, because they tend to vote in larger proportions. On the other hand, they may say that they've got to pander to their Tea Party base and they need another $1 billion from the Koch brothers, and so they're going to dig their heels in and try and screw poor people. I honestly don't know. For our viewers and listeners who don't know what you're talking about, these COLAs are the cost of living adjustments. They're based on a measure of inflation that is bizarre for retired people and for elderly people and for disabled people. They include things like, you know, whether the cost of, you know, when computers become more powerful and the price goes down on them, that's considered a negative with regard to inflation that offsets the fact that gasoline goes up, food goes up, and fuel oil goes up. And the fact of the matter, as Bernie pointed out, you know, for 18-year-olds, life is getting cheaper, or at least, you know, it's getting more powerful at the same price. But for a 60-year-old or an 80-year-old, life is getting a lot more expensive. They're not buying, you know, new iPads every year, but they are buying food every month and or every week, and they're buying their medication, and they're having to travel. So I'm sorry I can't give you any specific answers, but I would suggest very strongly that you call both your senators and your member of Congress there in Akron, Ohio, and you know, just let them know what you're up to, you know, what your concerns are.
How do you think about a shared Brown Bernie Sanders ticket?
I'd vote for it in a heartbeat. It ain't going to happen, but I'd vote for it in a heartbeat. Tom, thanks for the call. Don in Seattle, we have 40 seconds left in the show. It's all yours.
How big is the worldwide derivatives market as compared to how big it is in the United States, and what's the composition of them?
The worldwide derivatives market in 2000 was zero, roughly. I mean, you know, it was very, very small. It's pretty meaningless. And then with Graham-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act brought to you by Phil Graham and Enron in 2000-2001, that market and similar legislation passed in a couple of European countries, specifically the UK, that market grew to about $900 trillion. The entire GDP of the planet is $60 trillion. Right now, there's a big debate about how big that gray market is, bizarre commodity market, the gray part of the commodity market. Nobody really knows. The guess is, I think the best guess is probably $500-600 trillion that's still out there, and it's a time bomb waiting to happen. The person who has good information on this is Ellen Brown. If you go over to webofdebt.com, you can check it out. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, what does the right wing gain from their demonization of Islam? We'll confront Pam Geller. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Show up, tag your it, and our Sunday show, 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Free Speech TV.
You've
and satellite, Sirius
LV. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.